I earned my degree online at Arizona State University. I chose to get my degree at ASU because I knew that I'd get a quality education, they were recognized for excellence, and that I would be prepared for the workforce upon graduating. To be associated with ASU, both as a student and alum, it makes me extremely proud, and having experienced the program, I know now that I'm set up for success. Learn more at asuonline.asu.edu.
What's happening, family? And welcome to the In the Black of My Mind podcast. I'm your host, Al Thomas. So grab your favorite libation or stimulation, your comfy chair, and enjoy this episode with us. Do me a favor and go down to the bottom of the page and click subscribe and share and tell everybody. How many bodies? Everybody about this podcast. Today's guest is one of the most amazing drummers I have ever heard. He's played with, recorded, and or toured with the likes of Janis Ian, Larry Coryell, Randy Brecker, Bill Evans, Marion Meadows, Joey Melotti, Kevin Jenkins, Brian King, Vicky Sue Robinson, and Eartha Kitt, just to name a few. And he's just released a brand new album. That's right, I said album. I didn't say MP3, CD, or cassette. It's an album called No Boundaries. But more importantly, to me anyway, he's one of my big brothers, Artie Dixon. Dixon, how you feeling, bro?
Al, thank you so much for inviting me on your show and being able to share some of my experience with your audience and you.
Oh, man.
I'm grateful for this opportunity.
Man, it's my pleasure. Trust, it's my pleasure. Before we get into this, have you been able to locate Paul Spinner?
You know, a few years ago, I was in my post office.
Uh-huh.
And the person behind the post, the desk, his name was David, and he told me that his brother-in-law was Paul Spinner's brother.
Oh,
and
wow.
I said, wait, what? I got to get a hold of Paul. So he was able to give me Paul's number, and I did contact Paul, and we had a conversation a few years ago, and he told me that he had psoriasis in his hands, so he wasn't able to play bass any longer. But at the time, he was living in New Jersey.
Okay.
And but since that time, I've had no contact with him. I'm sorry about that because I was hopeful to be able to just invite him to come up here and hang out with us.
Right. Man, he was such a talented bass player, man. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. No, he was amazing. I was the first guy that I saw play the fingerboard with four fingers and play on the bottom with four fingers, like a cellist
almost. Right.
You know, I went to his house one day and he had a piece of wood in his garage. He said, I want you to remember that. Like about a month later, he showed up on a gig with a new bass. And he said, you remember that piece of wood? This is it.
Wow.
He was a beautiful person too.
Yeah, one day at the Foundry, I was digging his sound. And I said, yo, man, that amp you're playing, man, that really sounds nice. Well, who was that made by? He said, made by me.
Right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Where were you born?
So I grew up in a small town in upstate New York called Coxsackie. Mm-hmm. I was a predominantly white community. I grew up with my father, who was Irish, African, and Native American. Mm-hmm. My mother, who was Italian. Mm-hmm. I had three older sisters and one younger brother.
Okay.
My mother, being Italian, clearly stated that we had to go to church every Sunday.
Gotcha.
And we also had to go to confession every Saturday.
Oh, whoa.
So I look back at that and it kind of made me accountable for my behavior throughout the week because I knew I was going to have to tell that priest what I did.
Right, what you did, right? No doubt.
When I was around 5 or 6, my father lost his job due to eye disease, glaucoma. He was a truck driver. Oh. So that immediately threw us into poverty. We lived with my grandparents. And now I was 5 or 6 years old. I didn't know that we were poor because there was family around and we had food. But one of the things that struck me was, and that I recall vividly, is that there was a family in town that had twin boys, and their mother used to bring my brother and I their clothes. So that's how I knew there was something different for us. Mm-hmm. So my earliest recollection of playing something with regard to drumming was playing with tree twigs on oatmeal boxes.
Nice. Nice. It was said, necessity is the mother of invention.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Now, are any of your siblings involved in music at all?
So, no, but this drumming part of it is actually in my DNA. My mother played snare drum in an all-girl drum and bugle corps. Oh, wow. And two of my uncles played drum set in dance bands. So back then, you didn't go to see a concert, you went to a dance.
Right, dance bands.
It's different.
Yeah, nice. Right. So there was no DJs back then.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it's in my DNA. I tell people, you know, drums found me, I didn't find drums.
Nice. So when did you actually start playing music?
So I actually got introduced to the drums in sixth grade, mm-hmm. Taking drum lessons from the high school band instructor. So I had a pad and a drum book, pair of sticks, mm-hmm. and I used to leave that house that I grew up in with my grandparents so that I could have some privacy and walk over across the street into a dugout of the Little League field and practice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I could have some me time, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
But I excelled quickly. So when I was in seventh grade, I played in the high school band. Mm. They had three grades of solos that you would have to play. Mm-hmm. And if you were in 10th grade, you played a grade 4 solo. In grade 11, you played a grade 5 solo. In grade 12, you played a grade 6 solo. So I played a grade 4 solo in 7th grade.
Oh, wow.
I played a grade 5 solo in 8th grade and played a grade 6 solo in 9th grade. So I had this gift, but really wasn't recognized and it wasn't developed in a way that most musicians would develop a gift that they had. Mm. It took me a little longer to realize that I had this gift, so to speak. So being in the band in high school, I was taught how to read music, mostly from a snare drum perspective. They didn't have a jazz band. The band instructor was mostly interested in march music from John Philip Sousa.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, but when I was in 11th grade, I wanted to take saxophone. I wanted to learn how to play saxophone. Mm-hmm. So he gave me a tenor sax and gave me a book, and I went home. And I learned Blues Minor by John Coltrane.
Oh, wow.
Ba-da-da, 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 right? Uh-huh, so uh-huh. I came back the next day to school. I was in the practice room playing Blues Minor. I wasn't playing what he had given me in the book. So he came in and told me that he needed me to play timpani. So he took the saxophone away from me.
Oh, man.
You made that. So anyway, that was my introduction, actually, to jazz, was John Coltrane and Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa. So mind you, in this small community, most of the people who knew anything about drums were very familiar with Gene Krupa or Buddy Rich.
Right.
I wasn't introduced to any African-American drummers or black drummers until I got to college.
Mm, mm.
But... yeah, so that saxophone was taken away from me.
Oh, man.
I played in a band. I played in bands in high school. And we played, you know, popular music, R&B, rock music. Mm-hmm. And my first band that I joined was with a trio, a guitar player and a bass player. And they did a lot of instrumental trio music. But that was actually my first opportunity to develop the 10,000 hours that I needed to become good at what I'm doing.
Right,
you know, there's
right,
a book
right.
called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. And in mm-hmm. that book, he cites the Beatles and Bill Gates and a few other famous people. And his contention is that in order to be good at anything, you have to spend at least 10,000 hours. So
right.
That first group was the beginning of my 10,000 hours playing drums.
Gotcha.
When I got to college, that was when I got introduced to a whole host of drummers. My Max Roach, Art Blakey, Elvin Jones, Tony Williams. And I was playing with four bands. So I was playing with a rock band, a pop rock band. I was playing with a jazz quartet with a vocalist. I was playing with a jazz trio. And Santi Debriano was in that trio, and he's become a very famous bass player.
Wow.
And another jazz fusion group called Skytrain. So the piano player of that group told me I sounded like Jack DeJohnette and that I should study with him. So now I had no idea who Jack DeJohnette was.
But in
order to not sound ignorant, I said, really? You think so? So he said, yeah, man, you should go study with him. So he called me. His name was John Esposito, and he's become a very famous piano player in his own right. But he called me one day and gave me Jack's number. I called Jack. He answered the phone.
Wow. And
I remember this conversation like it was yesterday. I said, hi, my name is Artie. I'd like to study with you. And he said, what are you doing Saturday morning? And I said, coming to see you. And so he gave me his address, and it was about 60 miles away. There was no cell phone. I didn't have a four-wheel drive vehicle. So on my way to his home, I was directed off this main highway, and it wasn't long before I was on a dirt road. And it seemed like I was climbing up this mountain. I finally got to his mailbox and pulled in, and he was just building a brand new log cabin. And I knocked on the door, and he said, Artie? I said, yeah. He said, come on in. Just introduced me to his wife, Lydia, and they had a newborn swinging in a swing. So he said, why don't you go downstairs and go ahead and warm up? So I went downstairs to his studio, and he had this amazing sonar kit set up. And so I started playing a little bit, fiddling around, you know, and he finally came down and he said, well, let's play a little bit. So he got on this clavinet. He was playing so fast that all I could do was just play quarter notes on the riser. You know, and so finally he came over and started telling me how to let the stick do most of the work. And, you know, but that was the first lesson, and he never charged me. So,
really?
You know, we walked upstairs and we walked outside, and he got on his tractor and started mowing his grass. So when I was driving home, the thing that resonated with me the most now was not the music, not the drum lesson, was the fact that he was a drummer and had a family. And I remember some of my teachers in high school telling me to never expect to make a living playing drums. So that was monumental for me. It was huge for me to see a drummer who had a family. Now, mind you, I still didn't know who Jack was, right? So.
Oh, really? By the time you went to his house, you still didn't know
who he was?
No,
I still didn't know who he was. There was no internet. There was no internet.
Right, that's true.
So, and he just seemed like a regular guy, beautiful cat, beautiful spirit, and very polite, humble. And so one afternoon I was at Manny's music store in New York on 48th Street. And they had instruments and albums. So they had a kit that you could play on. So I was bold, so I sat down and played on the kit. And one of the managers came over to me and he said, hey, man, you know, you studying with anybody? And I said, yeah, I'm studying with this Jack. This is what I said, Al. I'm studying with this guy named Jack DeJohnette. Man, this guy's eyes lit up. And he said, wow, you're studying with the elite. And it was only then that I realized, maybe this guy must be somebody, right? So I went over and started sifting through all the albums and started seeing his name everywhere. Having his own albums and everything.
Right.
But, you know, the next week when I went to study with him, he was still just Jack to me.
Right.
And we've had that kind of a relationship for a long life.
Wow.
And you know, he... one of the things that I took away from being with him and watching him play was his sense of time, his sense of building and creating colors around a song. And while he's playing, being a storyteller. And that's one of the things that I got from him mostly. I remember one of the things he said to me, when you're playing a risible, imagine a tap dancer. And so that really resonated with me because I was already playing something like that, because I never played ding, ding, a ding, ding, a ding, ding, a ding. That was kind of boring for me. And I think maybe that was one of the reasons John Esposito said that maybe I sounded a little bit like Jack. But when I really started studying Jack with Jack, there's nobody that sounds like Jack.
You know? Right, I hear you.
He found his own voice. As I listened to other drummers, there's no one else that sounded like him. And he didn't sound like anybody else.
And you definitely found yours as well. It's interesting because I used to tell people, I said, ever since back in the day when I first heard you at the Foundry, man, I was just been amazed and stuff. I was like, yo, you got to hear this cat, man. He don't play like nobody else around and stuff. They said, what's about him is different than everybody else? And so my description was, he's lyrical.
Oh, thank you.
That was my description. Yeah, he's lyrical, you know. So, I mean, it wasn't, you're not going to get bored. Two, you have all these different things that you can go to, and it's not, you know, I mean, you're still in the pocket, but tastefully around the pocket, you have all of these other things that you bring to the table and stuff. And so that it's captivating, man. I was telling Marion this one night. I was at the Foundry, and you and Marion, and Marion's playing tenor, and you guys went into the song, and man, y'all, me and Danny Moore, we're sitting out there watching, and you guys took us to another place, man. I was, after y'all, that was like the last song in the set, and we were just sitting there like, wow, man, did you? Yeah, I saw it. Wow.
That's very kind of you. You know, when I left college, I ended up playing with a show band. So this is a true story. I was playing softball, and I was playing left field. Mm-hmm. And my brother came to the field and was yelling to me that a band in Albany, New York was looking for me, wanted me to go on tour with them. I ran off the field in the middle of the game, hopped the fence. My brother took me home. We put my drums in his car. I kissed my mother goodbye. He drove me to Albany, and I never lived home again after that.
Wow.
So the next day, I was on the road with a show band, and we went from Albany, New York, to Calgary, Canada.
Wow.
So working with that show band gave me this sense of the backbeat, because we played in front of singers, and they sang and danced, and they had a whole show. Mm-hmm. But the band was on the stage for a long time. So they had a jazz trio that played first. So I played in that. And then the band played a set. So I played in that. And then we did the show. So I played in that. So I played all night with the bass player and the keyboard player. But it really set me up to be able to understand this concept of a backbeat. Mm. And because the dancers were dancing to that. I was even using 2S sticks. They were huge sticks. Some people use those sticks for marching band.
Oh, right.
But it really gave me that sense of what I would have to play, and also be very structured, which was very different from jazz. So after that, after I left that group, I ended up in Connecticut. Jerry Moore was a percussionist in that group, and he lived in Stanford. And he called me one day and said that a band in Greenwich was looking for a drummer. So I left upstate New York in a blizzard for about 6 hours.
Wow.
No cell phone, no four-wheel drive vehicle. Got to Greenwich. Right. When I got there, they had a drum set, but they didn't have a bass drum pedal for the bass drum. So I played the bass drum with a mallet and played everything else with my left hand. And so they said, you got the gig. So that's actually how I came to Connecticut. And that was life transforming for me, because being in Connecticut set me up for a lot of other, many other occasions to be able to play and develop as a drummer.
Okay. Wow.
So the name of that band was DBFM. And it was a great band. But I was living in my car during this time.
Wow.
From November to February.
Really?
Yeah, so while I was living in my car and playing with this band, I got an offer to do a recording project for a rock singer, and that's where I met Joey and Paul Spinner.
Okay.
On that rock session, and the producer was Ron Frangipani. Ron Frangipani was instrumental in getting me to play some jingles in New York, and also instrumental in introducing me to Janis Ian. And so he mentioned to me one day that Janis was looking for a drummer and if I would be interested in playing with her. And I said, absolutely. Mm. So I rehearsed with her, auditioned for her at SIR Studios, and she liked the way I played, and I got that gig. But prior to that, I played with Marion and Joey in and around Connecticut, and ended up doing a lot of recording with Brian Keene at Scoville Sound Studios. Right.
That really
introduced me to a lot of musicians. You know, the only way you can find out who you are and what you can do in life is through your relationships with other people.
Right.
You can practice for years in your basement, but you never know how good you are unless you play with someone else.
Right.
So this really gave me an opportunity to work with a lot of players in Connecticut and really develop this this sense of playing different genres of music, not just jazz. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful for a lot of the musicians that helped me to develop my craft, especially my brothers, Marion, Brian, Kevin, and Joey. They played a huge role in helping me develop as a drummer and a musician.
Oh, right.
So one day playing with these guys, we played in Westport a lot. So one night we were playing there, and this couple, Alan and Sherry Snedeker, used to come to hear us play all the time. Mm-hmm. So one night Sherry asked me if I could teach her son how to play drums. And I said, sure, without even thinking about it. After I thought about it, I thought, wow, what am I going to teach this kid, right? But so I went back to my sixth grade book that I studied from. And so it was a Brubank book for drumming. And I gave this book to him and started teaching out of it. And now, you know, I started realizing how much I really enjoyed teaching.
And
enjoyed teaching as much as I enjoyed performing. So that was my first student. And that was the beginning of my teaching career.
Okay.
As I was performing in Connecticut, there was a piano player named Rex Cadwallader who asked me to play on one of his recordings. Rex was the head of music at Greens Farms Academy. So he asked me one day if I would be interested in teaching at Greens Farms Academy, and I said, sure. Mm-hmm. So that was my introduction to teaching at a facility.
Mm-hmm.
And and I've been there going into my 18th year.
Oh, wow. Wow. Let's go back a minute. You said you played with Janis Ian.
Yes.
That had to have been a great experience, man.
Yeah, it was tremendous because
the world.
Yeah, that was tremendous because it also gave me this opportunity to really learn how to play subtly behind a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And of course she traveled all over the world, and I have a tremendous relationship with Janis as well. But more importantly, it gave me an opportunity to really develop this sense of playing behind a singer and how to play simple, because I was used to playing a lot. to play little colors on the cymbal bell, you know, things like that.
Right.
But Janis was cool because she was she's an artist, a singer, songwriter, composer, musician, and she liked what I did for her songs. But I have to tell you, man, my first gig with her was at the Bottom Line in New York City, reviewer said that I bludgeoned all her music.
Oh man.
Yeah, but I got great reviews all over the world. But
These critics, man, the kicker is that the majority of the cast that got all this stuff to say, they can't play. They're not innovators in any stretch of the imagination. They, you know, they, man, I mean, They talked about Mingus, and they said, "Oh, Monk." And said he can't play. He plays out of time, out of tune, and you know, his timing is off, and all that kind of not understanding what he was bringing to the table and stuff. And I'm sure it was the same with you.
Sure. So we were playing Marion and I, and Joey and Paul. We were playing at the in Westport, but we were opening for the Heath Brothers. Mm-hmm. So that reviewer claimed that I was the John Bonham of jazz.
The what?
That he claimed his review that I was the John Bonham of jazz. For Led Zeppelin. But you know,
wow.
I don't. You know, it's nice when someone says something nice about you. But,
oh yeah.
But you know, like I said, the relationships that you build with people help you to understand who you are, and more importantly than all of that, you know, I'm here because I have God in my life,
Amen.
And no one can take that away from me.
Not at all.
It's a I'm grateful for my mom instilling in us this sense of that spiritual sense that we all had,
right.
that we all grew
right.
up with.
Right.
But yeah, so traveling with Janis was tremendous. We went to Israel. Mm. We went to Australia, South Africa. I was in South Africa during the apartheid.
Right. And you shared a story with me about playing in South Africa, because this was during the that apartheid. And I mean, I remember you telling me that in order to play there, they had to you had to become in order to play Sun City or something like that, you had to be made an honorary white man.
Yeah, well, Sun City was all white. You couldn't even go there if you weren't white. But when I played with Janis, her contract stated that her audience had to be diverse.
Okay.
Similarly, with Millie Jackson played there, and Chick Corea went to play there. Mm. All of those artists demanded that their audience be diverse. But one of the experiences that I had, man, I wanted to see this. I had been following this group, Ira Carey, for years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so they were playing at this hotel down the street from where we were staying in Port Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. And so I was so excited to be able to see this group because they were from Cuba. And they were playing like, you know, down the street from where we were at.
Right.
So I got all dressed, man. I'm like, I'm pumped. I got to go see this band. So I walk into the hotel and I said to the gentleman who was standing there, I said, I'd like to see the concert. And he said, well, you can't come here. And I said, no, I just want to come in to see the band. You know, I just want to go to the show. And he said, you can't come in here. And the third or fourth time that he said it, you're not allowed in here, it dawned on me that I was in South Africa.
Right, right.
And man, I walked out of that hotel. I was so angry, Al. I mean, I can't even tell you how angry I was.
Oh, I can imagine. But
yeah, but that was. But we had some other great experiences. I learned how to read diamonds, and got a chance to see a lot of different places that, you know, going into Cape Town, South Africa, and Port Elizabeth, and Johannesburg, and you know, it was just. And traveling with Janis was tremendous. When we went to Holland, we were there when they crowned the new queen, Beatrice.
Oh wow.
And I rode the elevator with Kool and the Gang and Karen Carpenter and a lot of dignitaries that were there for that coronation. But they also had a mock coronation on the other side of town where all the people that were living in they're actually like Bedouins living in empty buildings. So they had a mock coronation. I took a lot of photos of that. And but it was just interesting being in these places and historical times. We were in Ireland when the hunger strike ended. Ireland was beautiful. We played there with Christa Berg, who was their big star, and Peter Frampton. You know, just traveling with Janis again was just fantastic because she was cool. You know, she was a great person to travel with. She didn't require any challenges, anything that would make things challenging, you know,
right,
having the the limousine be a certain temperature.
Right. You know, only red jelly beans.
And
the dressing. Hey, this is Marion Meadows, and you're listening to and watching In the Black of My Mind podcast.
While I was here in teaching in Connecticut, I had a student come in one night, and he said to me, "Yeah, this guy called me to play up in Waterbury for $50, man. I turned it down." I said, "Really?" He thought I was going to endorse that.
Mm.
So I told him this story, Al. I'm going to tell it to you like I told it to him.
Okay.
So I said, a guy called me one time. His name was David Mills. He told me he was a bass player.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he wanted to see what his music would sound like with drums. He called his music blue light music.
Mm-hmm.
So he said that he would like to rehearse on Monday nights. And his son had kind of like a little toy drum set, but he could only pay me $25. It didn't take me any time to think about whether I was going to play mm-hmm. or watch Monday Night Football. So I went and played, and I learned his music. And he ultimately ended up booking a couple of gigs that paid $100. Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, I started rehearsal for $25.
$25, right.
So months went by, and I didn't hear from him. And then I get a call from a guy named Dave. I even had to think about who it was. He said, "Artie, this is Dave Mills." I said, "Oh, yeah, Dave, how are you doing?" He said, "I work for Yale, and we've come up with a project that would fuse a jazz trio with a string quartet." He said, "I'd like to commission you to play drums." I said, "I like that word, commission." He said, "And by the way, we're commissioning Ahmed Jamal to play piano."
Oh, wow.
And his bass player, James Kamek. I said, wow, that sounds great.
So
we had to rehearse with Ahmed to just get a sense of what this project was going to be like. So I went to Ahmed's house in Marlboro, New York, where he was living at the time, set up my drums, we rehearsed. And after we rehearsed, he said to me, "Maybe we could talk about you playing with me sometimes." And I said, "I would love to do that." The following Monday, we were at the Asai Quartet concert because we had to meet them.
Mm-hmm.
So while we were sitting at the concert, Ahmed leaned over to me and said, "I got a gig for you December 4th. So December 4th was ringing in my ears because I had just finished a recording for Randy Klein, and his CD release party was going to be at Trumpets in New Jersey that same night.
Oh, wow.
So I leaned over to him and I said, "Where's the gig?" And he said, "Carnegie Hall." I said, "I think I could do it."
Sorry, bro.
So when we left, I came home and I called a great drummer, great guy, great personality, can read and everything, Tony Lewis. And I said, "Tony, you working December 4th? He said, "No." I said, "Man, you got to cover this gig for me." So I called Randy and I said, "Randy, I have an opportunity to play at Carnegie Hall with Ahmed Jamal. I have a drummer that can do your gig, and he's willing to work. And he's willing to rehearse with you." I said, "If you don't like him, I'll tell Ahmed I can't do the gig." So Randy said, "Okay, yeah, I'll listen to Tony. We'll rehearse with him, and I'll let you know."
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I said to him, I wanted to get permission from Randy, because when I lived with my grandparents, one thing my grandfather told me that resonates with me. He said that when you die, anything that you've obtained, everybody's going to want.
Mm.
But the one thing that they can't take away from you is your integrity.
Right.
So fortunately, Randy rehearsed with Tony, called me and said, "Hey, man, go have a good gig with Ahmed." So now I'm rehearsing with Ahmed on Wednesday for the gig on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts to play a piece, starts to play a composition, and I start playing. And then he says, "Don't play until I point to you." So he starts playing again. He points to me and I start playing. And we play this song for about maybe 10 minutes.
Mm.
So when we finish, I had my tape recorder, my music stand, music, everything set up so I could, know what we're going to do at Carnegie Hall. So I said, "What's the name of that song?" And he says, what do you mean? I said, what's the name of that song? And he said, what do you mean? I said, I don't know that song. What's the name of it? He said, you don't know that song? I said, no. He said, you never played that song before? I said, no. And he said it again, you never played that song? I said, no. And then he came over, stood in front of the drum set and pointed at me. He said, you never played that song before? I said, no. So he said, that was Tones for Jones Bones by Chick Corea.
Oh, wow.
So we played a few more songs.
Mm-hmm.
And then he looked at his watch and he said, you know, my ex-wife brought in some free range chicken. Let's go eat. So we're eating. Mm-hmm. And while we're eating, he's telling some stories. And I'm thinking about, what are we going to play tomorrow at Carnegie Hall? You know?
Right.
So we go back and rehearse a couple more songs. He looks at his watch and says, be at the hall tomorrow at 2 o'clock.
Wow.
So I said, okay. So I get there at 12 o'clock. I'm set up. So we have a sound check. And the sound check wasn't a song that we played the night, the afternoon before. So now I'm like nervous, man, you know, because I don't know what we're going to do. And there's no set list. He hasn't given me a set list.
Wow. And you're playing Carnegie Hall.
So when the show starts, McCoy Tyner plays. This show was for, it was a benefit for Oscar Peterson, who had a stroke. So it was sold out. McCoy Tyner plays first. Then they introduce Ahmed, and Jimmy and I walk out. We sit down. Ahmed starts to play. He points to me. I play with him. We end that song. He calls another song, points to me. I play with him. We did that for, I don't know, four or five tunes. And we walked off the stage. I had no idea what I had just done. Right? But Dave Brubeck was the next act out. So I walked off and Dave said hello to me. He said, man, you remind me of Joe Jones. That was a nice compliment.
Wow.
And so we listened to Dave for a minute. So Ahmed sent a message to me to come and visit him at his dressing room.
Okay.
So I went to the dressing room and he said to me, I got a gig. I do a guy at a bar in Boston. You want to do it on Saturday? And I said, absolutely. But I need Vernell Fournier's number. So he gave me Vernell's number. I rehearsed with, I went to take a lesson on Friday morning with Vernell because Vernell played Poinciana. So I took a lesson with Vernell and he showed me what he did. I wrote down everything that he did with Poinciana. I came home that day, I practiced Poinciana for about 6 hours.
Wow.
I got up Saturday morning, I practiced it again. And then I went to do the gig with Ahmed.
Okay.
So while we're doing this gig, I'm trying to make this short. While we're doing this gig, there was a couple sitting right behind him because there's no stage at the Regatta Bar. And they talked through three songs. And the third song that he called was actually in 7-4. I didn't know the song, but Jimmy told me it's in 7-4. So he started the groove and I played in 7-4. So Ahmed stood up and he turned around and said to the couple, he said, now everybody has come to hear me play, but instead they've been listening to you talk. So now we're all going to listen to you talk. And the people left and the rest of the audience clapped him out of the room. But the next song he called was Poinciana, and I was ready for it. One of the few compliments that he gave me was right after that gig, we're walking down the hall after the first set, and he grabbed my arm and he said, you played that better than my favorite drummer. That's when I knew I had the gig.
Wow.
So when I stopped right there with my student, I said, so I want you to understand that $25 gig, I ended up at Carnegie Hall. I said to him, you might have just blown your career. I said, don't ever turn down a gig.
Wow.
I went to Danbury for free and put together my first quartet with Nick Berlick, Dave Anderson, and Ken Joffrey. For free.
Hi, this is Greg Thomas of Parliament Funkadelic, and you're listening to In the Block of My Mind podcast. Check us out. Woof.
As I stated in the intro, that you're an inventor, and the invention that you came up with was the bass drum lift. So, first of all, what is the bass drum lift for those that are watching that don't know what it is?
Let me first say how this happened. I was tuning my bass drum, and I got this great sound, and you know all musicians try to come up with their own voice. And sometimes it's the way you tune your drums.
Right.
So I got what I thought was my sound, this bass drum, mm-hmm. with the tuning. And so I put it down, I set it down, I put the pedal on it, and I played it with the pedal, and it was a completely different sound. So I took the pedal off, and I stood it back up on his spurs, and I'm tapping it with my mallet, mm-hmm. and there was the sound. I put it back down on the floor and put the pedal on it, and the sound was completely gone. So I was baffled by this. I had no idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. I woke up in the middle of the night thinking that I had to get that bass drum off the floor. So the next morning, I cut a piece of wood, a little piece of wood, and I just set it underneath the bass drum. And I put the pedal next to it. I didn't attach it to the hoop. And when I played it with the pedal, that was it. That was the sound. So I actually did gigs. I actually did some performances with this piece of wood underneath the bass drum.
Oh, wow.
So, and I would get these compliments on the sound of the bass drum. Norman Johnson, a great guitar player, and he had a studio up in Middletown that I recorded quite a bit at. One day I was playing with him and he said, "Man, that's the sound I try to get in my studio." You know, so.
Oh, wow. Right.
So what I decided to do was cut a piece of wood and I created this arc so that it would match the arc of the perimeter of the bass drum, underneath the bass drum. And I put this piece of wood underneath it and I used that instead of this other little piece of flat wood. And so I used that for a while and then I decided I want to attach my pedal to this piece of wood. So I went to a metal shop and I had them cut a little piece of metal. They screwed it to the bottom of the wood and I attached my pedal to this device. Now I had like a device. So I was in Bob Gatson's store up in Wethersfield. Bob Gatson is he passed away now, a beautiful person. He was a research and development person for some companies like Promark Sticks and some drum companies, Noble and Cooley Drum Company. And so I think I had finished a performance somewhere. Maybe I did a school performance and I stopped in his store and I had it and I brought it in with me and I gave it to him. I said, "Bob, what do you think of this?" And he looked at it. He looked at me. He looked at it. He looked at me. He looked at it again. Looked up at me. And he said, "If this was made in plastic, I'd put it in my store right now." I didn't even have to tell him what it was for.
Wow.
And it was only at that point that I realized maybe some other drummers might like to use this because I just made it for myself.
Right.
So I had a student of mine, Anthony Bianco, and he became a good friend. And he is a builder. He builds houses. So he made a jig to be able to create this device and make a few of them. And I'll tell you, I remember working in this place over in West Haven in this back of this building in this basement with his dad, Tony, and he had his pistol on. He had his pistol on this platform and we were making these lifts out of wood. With a metal. And so I told Anthony, Tony's son, Anthony, who was my student, I said, "If anything happens with this, I'm going to help you get your son through school." And so lo and behold, I made a few more. And then I decided to go through with this and try to get patented and everything. So I said to my wife, "You know, I don't know what this is going to cost, but I have to do this because so many people come up with an idea, they don't follow through with it, and they see it on the shelf. Somebody else did it." So here's what happened. And I've told this story to Vic Firth, the owner and founder of Vic Firth Drumsticks, some people in the industry, in the music industry, the editor of Modern Drummer magazine, the president of Sonar Drums. I told them this story and they said, "What happened to me in 1 week takes some people, not months, but years to get."
Wow.
So here's what happened. I told my wife over the weekend, "I got to try to go through this." She said, "Okay, go do what you got to do." So Monday morning, I texted a couple of mold companies. And I said, "I have a product and I'd like to see what it would cost to create a mold." And I sent it out maybe to like three companies. And not 15 minutes later, a mold company from Brantford called me, a guy named Nick. And he said, we got your email. We'd like to talk about it and see what you have. Can you come over to see us? I said, yeah, I'd come over right now. So I put my bass drum in my vehicle with the bass drum lift and a pedal. So I drove to Mold Threads over in Brantford. So I set my bass drum up, lift up on my bass drum on a table with the lift underneath it, and I showed them what it did. And I showed them how it transformed the sound dramatically. So they said, you know, a lot of people come up with ideas and they spend a lot of money on a mold, but they don't follow through with it. I said, I'm going all the way with this. I'm just letting you know that. I'm a drummer. I know what this is doing. And I'm confident that it's going to make a difference in the way that any drummer's drum sounds, right? So they said, okay. So they said, we'll sign a disclosure statement. They were very honest because I had no idea about a disclosure statement. It states that they would not tell anybody that we had this conversation, right? So they said, you need a patent attorney. I said, okay, yeah, I better try to get a patent attorney. Monday evening, I took my daughters to their piano lesson. And their piano teacher is Doreen Aiardo, was Tony Aiardo's wife. You remember Tony Aiardo?
Oh, yeah,
was
the singer. Yeah.
So his ex-wife now, Doreen Aiardo, was giving my daughters piano lessons. So she was telling me about this new book that she was putting out, teaching students how to play piano with colors, and she had a patent attorney. I said, what? I said, you have a patent attorney? I said, I need him. So she gave me his name.
Okay.
Raymond Nuzzo. So and she gave me his number. So the next morning, Tuesday morning, I called Raymond Nuzzo. He answered the phone. Every other time that I've been involved with him, since that point, he never answered his phone.
Oh, wow.
But he answered his phone that morning.
Right.
And I said, you know, I got your name from Doreen Aiardo. I have a product that I'd like to see if it could get patented on. And he said, can you come over right now? And wow. I said, yes.
Yes, I can.
The route that I was taking to go to his office was the same route I took the day before to go to Mold Threads. Only Mold Threads was in Brantford and Raymond Nuzzo was in East Haven. So I took the same exit. I just didn't go as far.
Okay.
Right?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So I get to Raymond's office and I bring all my product in, bass drum, the lift, my pedal. I'm showing him what it does. And he says, wow. He says, well, we can go for a design patent or a still the patent. There are two patents you can get. I'm forgetting the name of the other one. It'll come to me. So he says, you need to have a patent artist. I said, a patent artist? What does a patent artist do? And he said, a patent artist draws the product and creates all these angles and tells exactly what the angle is. It's almost like building a blueprint for a home or something or an office, whatever. He said, I have a patent office that I work with in Maryland, and they're very expensive. I said, okay. Could I have their name and address? Because I'm getting ready to go to Maryland on Wednesday. This was Tuesday, right?
Wow. Yeah,
so he gives me the name of the office in Maryland. And I leave Raymond's office. I go home. I tell my wife about what I'm doing. And so Wednesday morning, I get up. I'm getting ready to go to Maryland. So before I go to Maryland, I stop at a car wash to get my car washed. At a Toyota 4Runner. So while my vehicle is going through the car wash, there's a guy who's waiting for his car to get washed, and his name is Lance. And he's just a guy that used to come to see me all the time. So he's like a fan, you know? So I was talking to him. I said, Lance, you know, and so Finally, I said to Lance, what do you do? He said, I'm a patent artist.
Wow.
Now, wow. I get the chills. I'm getting the chills right now. I get the chills even telling people about this.
Right.
This guy said, I'm a patent artist.
Wow.
And so I said, what? He said, I'm a patent artist. I said, I need you. This is what he said to me, Al. He said, come see me after church on Sunday. I don't take any more clients. Now, he doesn't even know I go to church.
Mm.
He said, come see me after church on Sunday. I don't take any more clients.
Wow.
So now I don't have to go to Maryland.
Right.
So this is Wednesday. Thursday rolls around and nothing happened. Nothing significant about the lift anyway.
Right,
it's almost like God took the day off. Because Friday, I was doing a performance with Joe Beck, one of the great guitar players that played with Miles Davis, and Santi Debriano, the bass player that I was with in college with.
Oh, wow.
That trio that I had in college with Clyde Kreider. So we're doing a performance, and at the end of the performance, this guy comes up to me and he says, well, man, I really like the way you play. I've got this drum set that I'm distributing in America. I said, you're a distributor? He said, yeah. I said, I need you. Right? So Saturday morning, I was at his house looking at this Traps kit. And it's a nice little kit. I still use it today when I'm playing in churches and small restaurants. But I saw this Traps kit that he had. And I put my bass drum lift with the bass drum pedal underneath it. And I played his bass drum and he couldn't believe the sound.
Wow.
He couldn't believe how it altered the sound.
Right.
So we talked about his Traps kit and I said, I like it, but I think I can make it sound better with better heads. I use Evans heads. And so he said, yeah, great. So he got me an endorsement with the company from London. There's a guy named Bob Henrit, who was the drummer for the Kinks, and he's the one who designed this kit. Okay. So bottom line is, though, is that this guy's name was Joe Capello, and he said to me, do you have a distributor for this lift that you call it? And I said, yes. He said, who? I said, you. So that's what happened in this whole week.
Wow.
I had a mold company to make it. I had a patent attorney. I had a patent artist to draw it. And I had a United States distributor all in 1 week.
Wow.
Now, what this bass drum does, it lifts the batter head off the floor so that you no longer are attaching your pedal to the hoop. So the first thing that happens is you're preserving the integrity of the hoop by not scratching up your hoop.
Oh, right. Yeah.
None of the sound is going into the floor because it's off the floor. So all of that sound is projecting, so you have better projection of sound. And because you're not attaching anything to the hoop, and because that batter head is off the floor, it allows that batter head to resonate better. So now you have better resonance, better tonal quality, better projection of sound, preserving the integrity of the hoop. That's what it does. And it does that for any size drum. But I specifically made it for small drums. So I made it pretty high so that it could accommodate 18-inch drums and 20-inch drums. But after having regular meetings with Bob Gatson, who told me that there were a lot of 22-inch drums that were being sold, I actually had it modified and made it smaller so that it would accommodate not only 16, 18, or 20-inch or 22-inch drums, 24-inch drums, but Carrie Underwood's drummer was actually using it on a 26-inch drum.
Oh, wow.
So it accommodates all drums. So I had my United States distributor, and the first one was sold in Houston, Texas, at a Percussion Art Society convention. And after he sold it for a couple of years, after Joe Capello sold it for a few years, he decided he wanted to retire. So I had already had a relationship with Evans drum heads. I was endorsing Evans drum heads. And I would see the guys that were involved with Evans and D'Addario at the Percussion Arts Society convention, also the NAMM show, the National Association of Music Merchants out in Anaheim, California. So I had a relationship with these guys. And so I decided to call Sergio Bonsignore, who was the product manager for D'Addario and Evans. And so I said, I told him, I said, Sergio, my distributor is retiring. Do you think Evans would be interested in the bass drum lift? And he said, I think they'd be more than interested in it.
Wow.
Can you come and meet with us on Monday? And this was Friday afternoon that I spoke with him. So he sounded very interested. So Monday morning, I took a friend of mine with me, and I was planning on this presentation like you would see on Shark Tank. Have you ever seen Shark Tank?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I went to D'Addario. I set up my bass drum lifts, had the lift set up, and Sergio came in with another colleague of D'Addario. And I begin to begin my presentation, and Sergio's colleague said, you don't have to sell us on this. I already have two. We have one upstairs on the drum set, and Sergio has one.
Wow. So
now I said, well, let me just come over and sit down. So I actually sat down with the guys and started telling them about me so they would know who they would get involved with. And right. One of the things I mentioned was the holiday party that I have every year. And at that time, I think I had been having it for about 30 years. And I just wanted to know that when I get involved in something, I'm committed to it. And that's pretty much what I wanted to convey to them at the time. But, you know, we just sat and chatted and we started talking about music. It was one of the easiest presentations I think I'm ever going to have to make to actually try to sell something, you know.
Right.
And so we developed this agreement with D'Addario, and D'Addario started distributing it, and now they distribute it in about 22 countries.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
that is awesome.
It's been a tremendous relationship that I've had with D'Addario, and I'm very blessed and grateful for the relationship that I've been able to build with them.
Nice.
And they sell it every year.
So okay.
They just took another order a couple months ago. So.
Okay. Now, who's manufacturing?
So one of the things in our contract, there were two ways that they wanted to approach this. One of the ways was for me to just give it to them, and they would manufacture it and sell it. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, I've been working with these companies in Connecticut for all these years, and I don't want to just leave them. Mm-hmm. So the only way I would do it is we market, we manufacture it, and all the products that go on it, all the little Velcro and the other components that go on the bass drum lift are all created here in Connecticut. So I told, you know, I basically said to them that I don't want to abandon all the people who have been supporting me all these years.
Right.
So the way we worked it out was it would be still be manufactured here in Connecticut, and they would order it. They would send me an order form. I would send them an invoice. They would send me the payment, and I would send them the product.
Okay.
And so that's how it's been working, and that's been a blessing for me.
Yeah, I know, that's right. Wow.
So all the people that have been supportive through the years that were creating this product in Connecticut, we still maintain. It's a Connecticut-based product.
Yeah.
Connecticut-based and American-made.
American-made. I was just going to say, yeah. That's awesome.
Family. I told you Artie was a bad dude. He had so much information we couldn't contain it all in one episode. So make sure you tune back in and check out part two of Artie Dixon. In the meantime, y'all be blessed.